You're listening to Domestic Diplomat.
Welcome back to Understanding Europe. In this episode, we're going to discuss crisis management and also governance in the EU. Don't worry, it's not as complicated as it sounds. Well, it's pretty complicated, but we try to split into two parts. First, we talk a bit about what a crisis is. How do we manage a crisis? What does this do? Secondly, we illustrate how the EU actually functions regularly, but then also in a state of crisis. So without too much further delay, Cheryl, who's joining us today?
Yes, so since we're talking about crisis and EU management in crisis times, we are interviewing today two professionals from CIRIM. Our first guest is Professor Dr. Esther Verslaus, Professor of European Regulatory Governance and Head of the Political Science Department at FASOS. Her research focuses on the European Union, regulatory governance, policy analysis, policy implementation, compliance, agency, and risk governance. And our second guest is Johan Adriansen. He is the research coordinator at CIRIM and assistant professor at the Department of Political Science, also at FASOS. His research focuses on European public policy and the role and functioning of the EU's member states. So it's going to be a very interesting conversation, and let's get it started. Welcome, Esther. Welcome, Johan. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for the invite.
Same here.
So, as we said, today's episode seeks to understand how the EU functions or operates in a state of crisis, but also how it operates on a daily basis. What's the difference between those two states? So maybe to first start, it would be better to try to understand what constitutes a crisis, or how do we define a crisis? How does the EU come to a decision, oh yes, we are in a crisis, and then operates differently?
Yeah, that's a very difficult question to answer, in the sense that sometimes you hear people saying that we are now in a very different time period, in the sense that we have crisis after crisis. But yeah, in a way, this is nothing new or nothing spectacular. If you look at the history of mankind, if you will, there are always episodes and periods of crisis situations. So this idea that something special is happening nowadays, I would like to counter that. So what does constitute a crisis? Well, what is a crisis is very much dependent on who you ask. Let's take the ongoing refugee crisis. Asking somebody who works for an NGO trying to rescue refugees somewhere in Greece or Italy will have a very different perception and understanding of what this crisis actually is than when asking a Hungarian politician who has ideas about how many refugees should or should not be accepted to his country. So what is a crisis is difficult to describe. It depends on who you ask. It's in the eye of the beholder.
I think it's also interesting that, because you used the example of migration, and I think there's also the question of whether there's a strong correlation between a problem, because I think often when we think about crisis, there's an underlying problem, right? If you look at, for example, the number of refugees crossing the Mediterranean, it fluctuates. But our sense of crisis does not necessarily correlate with that. And there is also then different actors that want to make it a crisis. So there is also politics behind framing something as a crisis. I think in the US, to keep with migration, there's this whole debate about caravans of migrants moving through Mexico that will arrive at the border. If you would ask a Republican, they would say that that's a major crisis. I would say the majority of Democrats would not even notice that this is a crisis. Or you may not see a difference actually in the actual numbers achieved. I think that also you mentioned Hungary, where the perception that there is a migration crisis, despite not very much migrants actually going to Hungary, I think gives a good indication of how crisis actually is a subjective concept.
It's really interesting that you mentioned the framing and also the refugee crisis, because I was wondering if the framing would also have an impact on how the EU or a certain state responds to the crisis. For example, for the refugee crisis, if it's a humanitarian crisis, you would have different policies to tackle it. Or if it's an economic crisis, then you would have also different policies to tackle it. So I was wondering also the framing of the emotional bias maybe, or the political bias? What are the factors that go into how you frame a crisis?
Yeah, framing is key to understanding crisis situations and also to understanding responses to crisis situations. Indeed, as you rightly say, how those in charge of tackling a crisis, of handling a crisis, whether it's at a local level or national level or the EU level, that doesn't really matter in that respect. How those who are in charge of doing something about the crisis situation frame the problem will determine everything in terms of the type of policy solutions that are on the table and that are also perceived as acceptable, right? I think here an example from another policy domain would be very telling. When we had the financial crisis and after that the Eurozone crisis in the EU, what we have seen happening is that in many other policy domains, we have seen that different actors started to frame their policy initiatives also along the lines of economic and financially relevant. So that also ties in with what Johan just mentioned before, that this framing can then lead to an opportunity. If there is a crisis situation, like the case of the financial crisis a couple of years ago, we see that actors that before did not have an opportunity to push something through and to get something on the policy agenda suddenly strategically use the crisis to frame something that they are concerned about as belonging to that crisis situation and therefore using this as a window of opportunity to get something on the agenda. So, for example, we have seen a lot of initiatives in other sectors, for example, more social policy related issues that were suddenly framed as having an economic impact in the aftermath of the financial crisis that were being framed in light of this financial crisis.
No, I think in that sense, policymaking under crisis, or at least in terms of the framing, is very much to regular policymaking. And so that this sort of battle over in which terms are we going to discuss this issue. I think if you stick back to migrations, is it a story about refugees, a humanitarian challenge, if you will, or is it rather a social security challenge that we have to address? Is it a debate also between member states? Is it about burden sharing between member states? And if so, then so you enter then into other types of discussions also between different actors, whether it's a European versus national debate or whether it's between different ministries, for example, or different policy tools that we need to activate.
And if we're talking about different framing and different responses based on that framing, I was wondering, is it possible to talk about an objective mechanism to handle crisis or no?
The very short answer is no, because there can be a relatively objective problem, but how you frame it in terms of crisis language, that will differ so much between actors. And here I think we very nicely can illustrate this with an example from the recent COVID pandemic. There we very nicely see, or nicely is not maybe the best word to use in this context, but we very much see how different cultural factors play a role in how this COVID pandemic has been handled. There's cultural theory that divides the world in different worldviews, if you will, depending on how people interact with each other in different cultures. And they categorize it into four different categories, four different types of worldviews that apparently are out there in reality. And this influences how people are prone to handle crisis situations. And what we have seen is that in those countries where the worldview is most focused on this idea that people are responsible for their own handling and that governments shouldn't interfere too much, for example, the Netherlands, for example, the United Kingdom, you see that these countries also very much in the first months of the pandemic have been rather reluctant in having far-reaching measures for the public because of this idea of this underlying cultural worldview that this is it's up to the public itself to see how to handle that. Another really nice example from this cultural theory is, for example, there's really nice research into how people respond to hurricane alarms. The moment, well, in those areas in the world where there tend to be hurricanes, there's usually such an alarm system to warn people for an upcoming hurricane. And research using cultural theory indicates that the type of worldview very much influences to what extent people are actually prone to listen to these hurricane alarms. And also here in the individualistic societies where, you know, there's a tendency for people to think, well, I'm responsible for my own well-being. People tend to listen less to such hurricane alarms than in more, less individualistic societies.
Very interesting. Are there any other factors that come into play when we're framing a crisis?
Here we know from psychological literature that people tend to respond very differently to crisis situations. So there's different types of research showing how different people have different tolerance to risks and uncertainties. And where you are on this ladder, if you will, of being very open or very, acceptive of risks, or whether you're very averse to risks, will very much influence how you will perceive a crisis, and will also very much influence to what extent you're responding to a crisis situation. We also know from this psychological literature that men tend to be more acceptive of risks and crisis situations compared to women. We also know that conservative white men tend to be most risk accepting. So, you know, this linking this to also decision making in a crisis situation. If you have a committee of responsible people who have to deal with a crisis situation entirely consisting of conservative white men, you will have a different type of response, because these tend to be more risk-taking than when you would have a group of, let's say, leftist Latin American female make the decision. So we know that different people have different ways of responding to uncertainties and to crisis situations.
If you were to apply that to the US handling of the pandemic, you could basically say, well, the way that Congress is set up out of old white men might help explain why they were so hands-off, and then the minorities trying to get at least a bit more protection.
No, very much. And this is why it's also extremely important that in governing crisis situations that you have huge variety in terms of who actually sit around the table to make a decision. It shouldn't be too much of the same people, if you will, right? Because that also leads to a situation, this is again a term from the psychological literature, called biased assimilation. And this basically means that people, everybody, also all of us here around the table, we have a tendency to believe those things that are most in line with our own feelings and perceptions. So again, linking back to the refugee crisis as an example, if one as a person has a tendency to feel sorry for refugees and to think that we should be accepting and that we should have policies in place that allow a welcoming of refugees to a country, you tend to believe information that is in line with this perception much more, and you tend to perceive that as much more trustworthy and reliable compared to when you are somebody who has the opposite perspective. So yeah, this is exactly the same what you see also in social media, right? With what's the word I'm looking for?
Polarization?
Yeah, no, the filter that influences your feed.
The algorithm.
The algorithm, indeed. So us as humans, we also have such an algorithm in our heads, in the sense that we tend to filter information and we tend to believe the information that fits best to our way of thinking. Mm.
That's very interesting. I'm wondering also the role of social media in framing something as a crisis, because sometimes the policy is not responding to that, but then on social media it is. With like climate change, for example, and some policies are more reluctant to respond, or there's like a more of a political approach to certain industries. But then on social media or other media platforms, we're already in the doom. It's coming. So how does that play also in what's the push and pull between policy and social media, if in simple terms?
I think it's a state of crisis, right? So the sort of the algorithm selects hyperbole and amplifies any sort of crisis narrative, as if everything is like, I wouldn't say bad, but basically requiring action. So I do think that in that sense that it sort of acts as a magnifier, as a, how do you call it, megaphone, right? Yeah, that there is a sort of an outrage nonstop that feeds on this idea. So I would say that also amplifies the perception of crises requiring answers.
Mm, mm. Might it create also more problems, or might then civil society feel that there is no response to a certain crisis because it is framed as a crisis in the, in between air quotes, virtual world?
I think it floods the field, so it creates a lot of gray noise. That it becomes more challenging to, because we've been discussing different, I mean, how crisis is constructed, but in the end there is, I wouldn't say an objective truth, but in the end you still want to figure out like which problems require action, which crises are more real, if you'd like to put it that way, than others, which are more urgent in requesting a response. And I do think that basically becomes more challenging, because everybody feels that the crisis that they feel deep about should be the top priority of a government. That sort of obfuscates now what should we focus on, and then shifts also depending on who's in power, the types of crises that require a solution.
It's almost as if there's these two algorithms working at the same time. The social media one that shows us what we want to see in some ways. And on the other hand, we also want to believe things that confirm our own beliefs or our own worldviews. So in the way we could apply this to crises, especially viewing them and framing them as individuals or as a society, it's just constantly trying to, you know, getting some information, seeing something as, oh, this is important, this is now a crisis. And is this word, or is this term crisis, in your view, then overused in some ways? Because as you said earlier, it seems like we have never ending crises now. Every day, every week, there's a new crisis. And how can we navigate something that is a crisis if everything is viewed as a crisis?
I think it begins to lose its meaning. I think in the sense that it's less distinguishable from like a real or a inflated crisis. I mean, we lack perhaps also vocabulary. I think there is like distinction between different types of crises, whether they're fast burning or slow, below the surface, present, and so there are different terminologies also being created to sort of capture these distinctions as well. But I do think the sense that there is an overabundance, or basically everybody picks their own crisis, I think that does seem to be a bit more of a recurrent theme.
Yeah, and here we can link it back to what we also outlined before, right? That I think partly we can explain this overuse and overkill of crisis situations with certain people strategically using this to make their point and to win something. We very often see certain types of politicians blowing up something as a crisis, and here indeed the algorithms also come into play and make it easier also for such politicians to take advantage of framing and using something as a crisis situation. And you also can see that crises lead to such opportunities, right? So we have seen this very clearly after the attacks in the United States, 9/11. There were always calls, particularly from the conservative sides, for better security at airports. But they never materialized because there was no political agreement. So there were these, if you will, policy solutions lying on the shelf, waiting for a crisis to happen. And then 9/11 happened. And then literally within 2 weeks, Congress decided on these policies that were already there. They were already made, but there was no political climate for such policies, far-reaching security policies to actually materialize. But then a crisis occurs, and these policy solutions that were already there were then framed in light of this 9/11 crisis, and then we have very quickly new policies in place.
I guess there's the academic way of viewing it, the policy window, is that right?
Indeed, indeed, indeed. You learn something. Yeah. Very good. During the course, policy domains.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you also have it closer at home, right? And I think in Belgium, after the attacks on the at the subway, there was proposals on passenger name records. So the idea that you could control, or that you would have information about who comes into the country or who leaves, because one of the terrorists actually moved across, like from France to Belgium, if I recall correctly. Mm-hmm. And so in the regulation or the directive that that Belgium adapted, basically, they went far beyond any sort of ambition that the commission originally put in the proposal. So then you see politicians, particularly on the right, using this sort of opportunity to sort of pitch far-reaching policy interventions.
So same. But a lot of these crises are then also viewed through security lenses. So it's, they're securitarized in that sense. So a lot of these policies end up following that strain of thought.
I think it's even called penal populism, if I'm not mistaken. So the idea that you could use these sort of events to, for example, ask for higher punishments for crimes committed. So I think every time that we have an outrageous case on a murder or child molestation, then you get calls again for reinstalling the death penalty, to give an example.
I think this is a good moment to also then look at how we respond to crises, but maybe also contextualize it within the EU a bit more. It would be helpful to compare and contrast the EU's, I guess, procedures in states of crises versus non-crises. I think maybe let's start with a quick summary of how the EU governs practically between member states and institutions and the different institutions.
I think it mostly starts when a new commission comes into or is installed, that they develop this sort of broad agenda. I think the von der Leyen Commission made it sort of a geopolitical agenda in which a number of ideas and initiatives are already crystallized. I mean, this is, I think, based on broader developments that take place in the European Union. It's also being discussed with member states. So there's sort of there is preparation behind it, let's put it that way. And then based on that broad agenda, specific initiatives are launched by the Commission. And then member states in the Council and elected representatives in the European Parliament can basically comment, adjust, and ultimately adopt the piece of legislation. I would say that's in a nutshell the normal thing. So basically it builds on a slow, some would say very slow-moving agenda, but it is very well corroborated, very well deliberated, leaving quite a lot of time and space to hash out specifically technical details for which they would often, I think this is also part of the core competencies of the EU, to draft regulations. So it's very regulatory and often less politically savvy. That's, I would say, in a very, very small nutshell.
Yeah, and I would say in addition to that, what is very important in this normal state of affairs, if you will, in terms of how policy is being made in the EU, and Johan, you hinted at it already, is the consultation of experts. And there's a very long stage in which the Commission, who is responsible for initiating and drafting legislation, a very long stage of talking to all sorts of stakeholders and trying to come to, you know, the common level playing field and making sure that policies that are being proposed already to the Council and the Parliament for adoption, that we have a sense of these being widely accepted by all the stakeholders out there in the field. So it's indeed very deliberative, very cooperative, very much based on consensus, and very technical, very much based on a lot of technical details. So technical experts from national ministries play a larger role in this whole process than one would anticipate.
That's quite clear. And now let's flip it. There's a crisis. What does the EU do? Where should we start?
I think crisis can work in two ways. I think one way it can expedite existing pieces of legislation, because I think some of the problems that are crisisized or are framed as a crisis, we know them for quite a while. I think, for example, if you think about the Eurozone crisis, or at least the problems in the construction of the Eurozone were known already at its inception. So there were a number of proposals already laying around. Some of the reforms are already in the process. And then basically a state of crisis just expedites. To take an example of the area that I'm more familiar with in trade policy, we've had a lot of proposals being put on the table as part of the geopolitical agenda of the von der Leyen Commission. So these were already in the working because the world was already changing. So we saw the problems emerging in the neighborhood. We saw with the rise of Trump that the multilateral order was crumbling. So the EU started to respond in its slow legislative manner. But then crisis erupted in Ukraine, and you see a sense of urgency starts to emerge around existing initiatives. So I think in that sense, crisis expedites processes that are underway or perhaps increase the ambition that they've put.
Actually, in our last episode, sorry to interrupt, in our last episode, we're talking about it, and it was very much the von der Leyen Commission who almost prepared at least the first round of sanctions ahead of time, almost having them ready, and as soon as Russia invaded Ukraine, they were very fast to act because of this. So this anticipation of crisis is also part of the way it functions.
I think in good governance, I would say, we'd always anticipate some types of crisis to emerge, right? So the same applies to health crises. You should have contingency plans in place. I think that's good governance. I think the fact that sometimes they weren't in place, I think that made it for the EU a specific crisis. So I think in the case of the Ukraine sanctions, to me it seems as part of proper preparations that you would have these plans ready to go to react swiftly. I think the sort of the expedition or the speeding up of processes that I refer to, I think it relates to just to prioritization.
Yeah, and in that sense, we again see here how what makes crisis decision-making different from normal the normal state of affairs is that it indeed creates opportunities, right? We discussed this before, but I think I can give another example to illustrate how that works. There was always the willingness of member states to do something more in the field of financial cooperation, but this was simply impossible because of also the power of the financial sector and the independence of very strong banking actors. So it basically wasn't possible and feasible to do more at the European level. So this was financial policy was very much arranged at the national level. Well, enter the financial crisis and the Eurozone crisis, and we see within a couple of years we have three extremely strong agencies in the European Union that have far-reaching powers in the sphere of the financial sector and the way in which banks are being regulated. So it allows policy options that were perceived unfeasible before. I think what crisis does to policymaking is that new policy options that are previously unthinkable suddenly become realistic. And perhaps the difference is that I think the number of actors around the table becomes smaller in crisis decision making. So what we've sketched before is the enormous length also of deliberation with experts, technical experts in the field. You simply don't have the time in a crisis situation, right? So it needs the speed of things is hugely different. So you see that the group of people deciding becomes much smaller, and that obviously does something to how decisions are being made.
Yeah, no. It also forces you to compromise quicker, because or to leave parts that you can't hammer out all of the details. So I think there is a greater willingness to compromise, because you need a response to a crisis, and then you can't just hold out and just play a waiting game, which often happens. Not responding basically has great costs.
Yeah, but the downside of this is that if you then start with a situation in which the decisions are being made by, well, as it is usually the case, this relatively small, close group of people, then thinking back to what we discussed earlier, if then this group of people is relatively like-minded in terms of worldview and type of personality, you know, the same if on this scale of risk aversion, then you run into the risk that, decision-making doesn't run that well. So ideally, you ensure that those, that relatively small group that you need, because otherwise you can't take decisions, you also somehow need to ensure that this is a relatively a group with different types of actors in it. To give a concrete example, I think we can be relatively critical in the Dutch situation in the handling of the COVID pandemic. We had this decision-making body called the OMT, the Outbreak Management Team. And if you look at the composition of this decision-making body, well, officially they only they advise the government, but the government always followed their advice. But the composition of this team was, it was not diverse enough. It was mostly experts on the disease itself. But in order to really properly debate and make good decisions in such a crisis situation, you need diversification of expertise in such a decision-making team.
In that example, to what extent does the national government overweighs the policies of the EU in general? So we're talking about policies in a certain crisis state, but then giving the concrete example of the COVID pandemic, different member states reacted differently. How does the communication go?
I think it's difficult to answer in general, in the sense that it very much depends on the type of crisis and the type of policy field, because there's huge variation in what competences the EU has actually in certain policy fields. And in this example of the COVID crisis, health is something that is not necessarily regulated at the EU level, but where the member states still have a huge amount of competences. We now see that the crisis will change this, because there are now calls for creating a European Health Union. So I predict that in the next couple of years, we see the adoption of a huge amount of new legislation in the field of health, where we see more competences at the EU level. But this fact that the EU did not have competences in the field of health, or at least not far-reaching, led to a situation that at the start of the crisis, let's say the first half year or so, member states really just acted on their own. And of course, there was coordination somehow, but every member state really had its own policy. And you only see that later in the crisis that things start to change. So they set up an EU Emergency Response Coordination Center, and they set up a Health Emergency Preparedness Authority. So they started to liaise and communicate much more at the EU level the longer we were into the crisis. So COVID also being a relatively long crisis, we saw this shift of competences to the EU level. But this might be, I think it's a completely different situation in the field of the Ukraine invasion.
Yeah, I just wanted to echo it depends a lot on the cross-border, or whether a crisis has cross-border ramifications. Mm. I think that's one of the main elements of whether it would have an EU response, or whether an EU response is expected or not. I think in the Ukrainian crisis, I'm not an expert on that topic, so for me it would also be difficult to say. I think where it does touch, for example, if to give somewhat of an other example, I think there is a policy also of the EU. The EU member states still have their national foreign policy. And I think in one case, Lithuania had a dispute with China over Taiwan. Now, China responded targeting the Lithuanian, or diverting trade to Lithuania. So then it basically becomes a challenge also of the EU, because the EU's internal market and its common commercial policy is unified. And so then the question also came at the European level, whether that this sort of actions, this coercion of individual member states, should not be met with a collective response. And then we enter again into a sphere of at which level do we expect responses to be taken? Because individual member states, specifically if they're small, can't act against. I think, and then there's a benefit from pooling, much in the same way, I think, in terms of how vaccines were procured, or how we've dealt with how every member state tried to deal with the mouth covering masks, or tried to procure them, but then also encountered some challenges, and then thought there's benefits to a European response. So to me, it really much depends on the nature of the crisis, and whether actually it does has cross-border consequences, or if there's an added value of pooled sovereignty in a way, or of collective response.
So on the one hand, it's the competencies of the EU, and if there is a risk that something is cross-border. But on the other hand, sometimes just innovation happens when a pragmatic view that, this could be better coordinated through the EU rather than us individually doing that from the point of view of a member state. So that's kind of the two two of these sides of EU crisis management in that sense.
Yeah, I'm just now second guessing my example, to be honest. But I think it's more of, because it depends again whether you would consider that an acute crisis that requires a European response.
No, I would say that that does make sense. And I would actually like to say that your example did make sense in the sense that when you look at COVID and the handling of the EU of this this situation, or let me rephrase that, the way in which the member states allowed the EU to handle it, right? Because it's sometimes there's this public perception of the European Commission being this all-encompassing actor that dictates what we do. Well, we don't do anything in the EU if it is not the member states agreeing that we do that, right? So member states have much more power here than is sometimes alerted to in the national media. So where do we see that the EU was stepping in the COVID crisis? Indeed, in the procurement of vaccines. Here we see that the economy of scale really just helps, and single member states alone find it difficult to have these contracts with these individual companies. So it is much more logical to do that together. Whereas when talking about, lockdown situations, there's much less need for this being exactly the same in all different European member states. So also there you see that member states act much more on their own. So it also depends, indeed, as Johan rightly illustrated, on the mutual benefit of doing things together in a crisis situation.
Can you respond to the crisis on your own? I think basically that's sort of a functionalist argument of whether you could manage the crisis on your own. And I think if you can't, then there's an incentive for greater cooperation.
Yeah.
And I think that brings us to a last point on this topic is, when these decisions are then made, there could be issues of effectiveness, transparency, legitimacy. So yes, we have we view maybe that a response is needed on a EU level, but then it's made by a handful of people at a high level, let's say, and because it's needed fast, it's needed immediately, and then we run back into the issue of who's in the room, who's making these decisions, how similar are they in thinking and background? What are the consequences on an EU level, maybe, of decisions made in a state of immediate crisis?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And also, it's a potential problem, huh?
I think it's a nuanced answer. I think on the one hand, there are benefits, because I think a crisis is an opportunity, and then you can actually then fix problems that should have been fixed long ago. In the Eurozone, we knew about some of the problems for a long time. I think Paul de Grauwe used to say that, well, we've built a European Monetary Union, but we forgot to put a roof over its head. and then the crisis emerges, and that actually then we need to make the roof. So in that sense, it can actually help to fix policies that were ill-constructed, perhaps because they were so politically. That if you enter into a negotiation and everybody wants to get something out of it, you exit basically with a policy that is suboptimal and it has some flaws. And then a crisis actually can just highlight the problems with the policies that you have. So in that sense, it can fix broken policies. On the other hand, I think it may also risk overshooting. Fear is the worst advisor that you'd have, and that basically, because you just want to do something or appear to be doing something, that you start overshooting or start going way too far in terms of adopting policies to address the crisis. So I think in terms of, and that's what we call output legitimacy, whether policies meet the purposes that they're designed to do, or at least in terms of the desires of the population that it addresses. On the input side, so the legitimacy of the policy-making process, I think Esther already alluded to that sometimes it may also not be as representative because you're dealing with fewer people. There is also less scope for questions of transparency, of stakeholder involvement. So the policies that can come out of it may also be more contested, and I think that's what we've seen specifically during the pandemic, where the absence of people, for example, working in the cultural sector or working in schools, the fact that they were absent from many of these sort of expert bodies also hampered the legitimacy in the eye of the public of the policies that came out of it. So I think the speed by which you then basically get to results is better, mm-hmm. because you need a swift response, but at the same time, you may lose the legitimacy that you normally would have.
That was really, I think, a nice way to end this section and bring us towards the end of our podcast, actually. It went very fast. In our last section, in our third section, on the first hand, we'd like to thank you, but on the second, we'd ask you to bring an additional source for our listeners to explore this topic a bit more. So we call it secondary sources. So who would like to go first?
One that I would like to recommend that I thought also was very interesting to read is it's a book by George Papakonstantinou, who used to be a finance minister during the Greek crisis. So his book is called Game Over, The Inside Story of the Greek Crisis. And actually it's a first-person story about the experience of him as a minister of finance entering into the Greek crisis and navigating that crisis. So it gives you a very nice insight also in EU policymaking, because he also talks you through visits to the European Council or visits with other ministers, with the IMF, the negotiations that took place, but also the domestic politics and so forth. So I thought that was a really nice, and also reads really well. So it's not a sort of an academic dry book, but it actually is a really interesting insight. And the other that I wanted to propose is Alarms and Excursions from Luc van Middelaar, who actually wrote a nice book on the differences between policymaking under business as usual, where he argues that this shift towards trying to address crisis also requires a different focus by focusing on events, he calls it. So it's called Alarms and Excursions, Improvising Politics on the European Stage, and it's also quite nice to read.
I mean, those will, of course, be linked in the description of the episode. You've got an upcoming course, no?
Yes. Am I wrong? Yeah, indeed. Yeah. So in the next period, we will have a course on the EU as a crisis regulator, if you will. So in this course, students who signed up can actually select their own crisis, and then they are going to explore this crisis and see how the EU actually handled and tackled that specific crisis, and they also have to then write a blog post and actually do some policy recommendations to the European Commission on how to handle this specific crisis. So I'm looking forward to that course.
I'm looking forward to hearing how it goes. And thank you very much for both of you for coming today. And thank you everyone for listening.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
The music for the MD podcast episode has been produced by Stone Ocean. And this podcast episode has been produced, recorded, and edited by Brendan Hogan and yours truly, Sharel Abdullah. Talk to you soon.